Today is Tuesday the 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives this week will debate legislation that establishes procedures for the next phase of the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is taking away one of the key arguments that U.S. President Donald Trump has had against the impeachment inquiry, which is that it's not formal and therefore not a legitimate inquiry.
Also ahead, Chile's President Sebastián Piñera has asked all his cabinet members to resign and promises economic reforms as he attempts to restore control after a wave of mass protests in the country. Those stories and more coming up on today's International Edition. The U.S. House of Representatives will begin debate on legislation to establish procedures for the next phase of the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced in a letter to Democrats on Monday that the House will vote to formalize the procedures in the ongoing impeachment inquiry with a resolution that will outline the terms for public hearings, the disclosure of deposition transcripts. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins me on the phone with details on the latest move by Congress that will also set procedures to transfer evidence to the House Judiciary Committee and due process rights for President Trump. Catherine, thank you very much for joining us on International Edition. Let me start off by asking you, Speaker Pelosi announced today that Congress will debate legislation this week that establishes procedures for the next phase of the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. What does this mean?
Well, this is actually a fairly significant development on Capitol Hill this week. What it means is that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is taking away one of the key arguments that U.S. President Donald Trump has had against the impeachment inquiry, which is that it's not formal and therefore not a legitimate inquiry. With this House floor vote later in the week, Nancy Pelosi will be able to enforce those subpoenas that she's been sending to the White House and to other government agencies, attempting to build a document-based case for the impeachment of President Trump.
What do you make of the timing of this announcement? I mean, earlier she had said that it's not necessary or required to have this procedure or to have this vote in Congress. Is she doing this out of pressure? And do you feel like by doing this and undercutting some of those complaints that this was an unfair process, that she will be able to bring some members of the GOP on board?
Well, it's highly unlikely that the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would be able to bring any members of the Republican caucus on board for the impeachment of President Trump. But you do bring up a great point that the timing of this is really interesting. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said previously, and she was correct in this, legally speaking, that the House of Representatives does not have to hold any formal vote to authorize an impeachment inquiry. The U.S. Constitution already gives the House of Representatives the power to impeach a president of the United States. But what it does show is that President Donald Trump has really put her in a really tough position by refusing to hand over these documents. This is really a sign that she has no choice but to box him in on the other side and say, well, now this is a formal inquiry. Now you have no reason not to hand over those documents. So it's a strategic move, but in a way it shows that President Trump is really involved and in charge of this process so far.
And today, House Democrats threatened to bring to charge a key witness in their impeachment investigation with contempt after he defied a subpoena and did not show up to Capitol Hill today for questioning. What can you tell us about this witness, and how important is this development?
That's right. So this is another example of how defying those subpoenas really put Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats in a difficult position where they have to be able to enforce them, and they have to be able to say, well, President Trump is now defying a subpoena for a formal impeachment inquiry, and he has to comply with that. They have to have these witnesses who are involved in U.S.-Ukraine foreign policy to be able to come up to Capitol Hill, give their depositions, and provide a full picture of what happened both before, during, and after that phone call that President Trump made with the Ukrainian president.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. And U.S. President Donald Trump is celebrating the successful U.S. commando raid in Syria that neutralized Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, belittling him on Monday as a sick and depraved man who is now dead. VOA's House Bureau Chief Steve Harmon reports.
Speaking at a convention of police chiefs in Chicago, Trump touted that his administration had accomplished what a previous president should have done years ago, ensuring the demise of the Islamic State leader.
He's dead. He's dead as a doornail. And he didn't die bravely either, I will tell you that.
The president says he hopes to release some video from the operation. Defense officials say the video and images from the raid are undergoing review, so excerpts can be declassified and made public. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper says that the security situation in Syria remains complex after the killing of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi over the weekend by U.S. Special Forces. He says that there's still a threat of state-sponsored and non-state entities that are vying for control of northern Syria's resources. Mr. Esper and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, briefed reporters Monday at the Pentagon on the operation that led to the death of al-Baghdadi. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about the briefing at the Pentagon.
So, Carla, what do we learn from this afternoon briefing held by Secretary of Defense Mark Esper?
Well, we found some fascinating new details about the raid against al-Baghdadi. We found out that when the U.S. forces went in to conduct this raid, not only was Baghdadi killed during this raid, he detonated a suicide vest. Not only did that happen, not only did U.S. officials get some new intelligence from the Islamic State, but they also captured two Islamic State combatants. General Milley, who is the top U.S. general in the United States, said that there were two adult males that were taken back with U.S. forces when they left the compound. In addition to that information, we are also learning some new information about the oil fields in northeast Syria. The reporters that were present were asking about these oil fields and how that would play into the fight against Islamic State. And Secretary Esper did say that there were going to be more U.S. troops going into these oil fields to protect them and guard them. I actually asked Secretary Esper how that plays out in the overall presence of the United States in Syria. I said, you know, at the end of the day, over these last 2 weeks, do we have more U.S. forces or are we going to have less U.S. forces in Syria? And he told me that in the end, he wants to reinforce the presence now, but there will be fewer U.S. forces than were in Syria before.
What else do we know about the staging of this operation, how it was conducted, and what or where, if that was disclosed, where the troops and the personnel and the materials came from to carry out this raid?
Well, they were very, very... very careful not to give any of this information out. I had learned from another source that the raid originated in Iraq, but Milley nor Esper would give those types of details today. They just kind of said, we're not going to go there. They came in and they went out, and this is all we're going to give you at this point.
There's been a lot of questions to the president about whether or not any of the information, any of the video that was gleaned during this raid would be distributed. The president has said that they were looking into that. Was that brought up at all?
Yes, that was one of the things that was discussed. Secretary Esper and General Milley said that there were photos and there were videos and they were looking to release those. They were going through the declassification process at this point and they were hoping to release those to the public as soon as possible. When there were questions asked about al-Baghdadi's body, they did confirm that al-Baghdadi has been, his remains, I should say, have been disposed of properly, but they would not elaborate. I have learned from an official that they disposed of his remains at sea, so he was buried at sea.
This raid was the culmination of months of intelligence gathered by various assets in the region, including the Kurds. But was any question asked about what the working relationship was with the Kurds now in the wake of the withdrawal from U.S. troops and the Turkey offensive into the region?
I actually asked General Milley about that because the SDF commander, Muslim Abdi, had said that one SDF member was part of this raid. General Milley was he held all the details close to his chest, but he did say that this was a U.S.-only operation. He would not comment about how any other members may have gotten to this or taken part, but he said that when it came to getting on the helicopters and going in, this was a U.S.-only raid.
Is there anything else that you can share with us about what was gleaned from that press conference?
So one of the interesting things that we asked the secretary and the general was what would happen in the event that Syria or Russia would try to take these oil fields that the U.S. has now been instructed to guard. And General Milley definitely did not want to answer the question during the press conference, but after pressed again, Secretary Esper did say that the short answer would be yes. If necessary, the U.S. would deny these oil fields to the Syrians, they would deny these oil fields to the Russians because, as he put it, the SDF needs these oil fields, needs access to this oil revenue in order to arm the troops and guard the prisons in the fight against ISIS. And that is the point that the United States is making. The fight against ISIS is still continuing, and they're still going to be working with their Syrian Democratic Forces partners.
That's VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking to Steve Miller. The court heard on Monday that a global ring had been involved in smuggling the 39 people whose bodies were found in a truck near London as the driver faces charges of manslaughter and people trafficking. And the United States Trade Representative is studying whether to extend tariff suspensions on $34 billion of Chinese goods set to expire on December the 28th of this year. And the U.S. will allow nearly 200,000 Salvadorians shielded from deportation under temporary protected status an additional year to live and work legally in the country. This follows high-level negotiations between the two countries. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Chile's President Sebastián Piñera has asked all his cabinet members to resign and promised reforms as he attempts to restore control following mass protests in the country. President Piñera's latest move comes as he struggles to contain widespread unrest that has gripped his country. Reports say that at least 20 people have been killed since rioting broke out in response to a 4% rise in subway fares that turned into mass expression of anger over what Chileans say is increasing inequality in the country. Dr. Craig Deer is the chair of the Strategic Initiative Department at the National Defense University's College of International Security Affairs. He tells me that this latest move is not likely to calm the protesters. Dr. Deer, thank you very much for joining us. Chile's president asked all his cabinet members to resign and is promising reforms as he attempts to restore control. What kind of reforms is he promising, and how will the dismissal of his cabinet help make his case to the protesters?
Well, it's not entirely clear yet exactly what reforms he's promising. And we have to remember, 2 weeks ago, he was in the middle of his second term and things were going relatively normally. And then based on the decision to raise the subway prices, the metro prices, we see this explosion of discontent. So I think we need to analyze a couple of the factors behind that and truly understand what's going on. And in fact, they need to do that before they just come up with a series of new policy proposals that may not be addressing exactly what needs to be fixed.
Okay, so then let me ask you this. Protesters are angry that that many Chileans have been left behind in the country's economic development. But statistics, economic data, says that overall poverty in the country has gone down over the years. What are some of the factors behind this growing income inequality?
Well, as you and your audience may know, Latin America has long been recognized as one of the most, if not the most, unequal regions in the entire world. It's a region of tremendous wealth, but also tremendous disparity and wealth, the Gini Index, as Brazil as the number 10th country in the world with among the worst levels of inequality. Mexico is up there ahead of Chile. So while it is true that Chile has inequality problems, it's not the worst in the region. And in fact, it's been true since the 80s and 90s that the Chilean economic model has been one to be modeled. But it always remains a challenge as you develop economically that growth is uneven. And clearly, a lot of the countries in the region, to include Chile, haven't figured out how to fix that.
Now, initially, President Piñera responded to the protests in a different tone. He declared it, saying that we are at war with a powerful enemy, and he deployed the military to impose order. Could this have been handled differently? And by using such a strong language and deploying the military, did he further inflame the situation?
Well, sure. The answer is he, of course, could have handled it differently. And in fact, the manner in which he handled it did, in fact, inflame things. Another factor that we need to mention, however, and not minimizing his tactical mistakes as he reacted to this, is what the Organization of American States has pointed out, of a rather significant influence of Cuban and Venezuelan financing and organization to exacerbate the situation. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not minimizing the level of inequality. I'm not minimizing the poor decisions made at the outset of the protests, but they were seriously exacerbated by an element that is attempting to create further disorder and instability throughout the region, not just in Chile. We see it in Peru, we see it in Ecuador, we see it in Bolivia. So it's an issue that's larger than just Chile.
Mm. How do you see this ending for President Piñera and his government, aside from just having, reforms, economic reforms, which I don't think that they would have immediate effects? How do you see this ending for the president and his administration?
Well, as Yogi Berra always said, it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. But, of course, in the short term, it's not going to go well. It is a serious situation. He has, by not handling it well immediately, it's going to be that much more difficult to recover. As you know, even if you were to devise the most solid economic plans to implement, in a country that's 17, 18 million people with a relatively sophisticated economy, it will take months, if not years, for that to change.
That was Dr. Craig Deer, chair of the Strategic Initiative Department at the National Defense University's College of International Security Affairs. He spoke to me earlier in Washington, D.C. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has accused Iran of seeking means to launch missiles at Israel from Yemen, where Tehran support Houthi rebels. Netanyahu made the remark during a visit by a U.S. delegation, including presidential advisor Jared Kushner and U.S. Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin. Israel's longtime leader is facing an uncertain future at home after he failed to form a governing coalition following two elections. VOA's Zlatka Hoke has more.
Netanyahu spoke of Iran's threat to Israel at an event in Jerusalem on Monday, coinciding with the visit of high U.S. officials.
Iran wants to develop precision-guided missiles that can hit any target in Israel within 5 to 10 meters. Iran wants to use Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen as bases to attack Israel with statistical missiles and precision-guided missiles. That is a great, great danger. To ward off this danger, we have to do two things. First, we must unite, because in the face of danger, we unite.
But at a meeting Sunday between Israel's longtime leader and his chief political rival, Benny Gantz, unity remained elusive. Israel's President Reuven Rivlin has tasked Gantz with trying to form a government after Netanyahu failed to do so after two inconclusive elections this year.
Yesterday I met Likud Chairman Benjamin Netanyahu. It was a thorough meeting. Unfortunately, we didn't manage to achieve any real progress. I hope we will achieve it in the future.
Both Netanyahu and Gantz met with visiting U.S. officials on Monday. Netanyahu called for more U.S. sanctions against Iran. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the economic sanctions have worked so far, and more will be imposed if needed to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons.
We are not doing this to hurt the people of Iran. We are doing this so that Iran stops their bad activities and exporting terrorism, looking to create nuclear capabilities and missiles, and we will continue to ramp up more, as you've said.
Israel also expressed concern about Turkey's incursion into Syria.
When we see Erdogan continuing with his aggression, with terrorizing the life of the Kurds, he has been doing it in Turkey, but now he's moving into Syria, we cannot be quiet, and we call the international community to take action on that.
A Palestinian official accused Israel of violating international law in a similar fashion regarding the Palestinians. The U.S. delegation did not meet with Palestinian leaders during this visit to the region. The Palestinians ruled out any talks with U.S. officials after U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Palestinians want East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
A new report from two prominent human rights groups says that the Tanzanian government is abusing the rights of journalists and opposition parties. The report released Monday shows the East African nation has adopted repressive laws that restrict the activities of the media, non-governmental organizations, and opposition groups. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In a joint press conference in Nairobi, representatives of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said Tanzania's government, led by President John Magufuli, has oppressed voices critical to his administration since taking power in 2015. Amnesty International Tanzania's researcher Roland Ebole said they spoke to 68 people for the report and found reams of documentary evidence to back up the accusations.
We got charge sheets in cases of those who had been arrested or presented or charged by the police. We obtained court judgments, court decisions or court documents by those who were arraigned in court. We obtained photographic and video evidence by those who alleged different forms of violations.
President Magufuli came to power in November 2015 with a promise to fight corruption. He was known for shutting down companies and firing government workers without due process. Once in office, he moved to shut down anyone who challenges authority. In 2016, legislators approved a Magufuli-backed law that gives security agencies the power to search media organizations, seize their equipment, and close them without a court order. In 2017, the government closed down two newspapers it accused of inciting violence and has since revoked licenses of three more media organizations. Muthoki Mumo of the Committee to Protect Journalists says the government cannot root out corruption while oppressing journalists, who are often the ones who report on officials' misdeeds.
He came to power with an aggressive anti-corruption agenda. But the question that comes up again and again when we do this research is, how do you expect to implement this? Or how do you expect to achieve these goals if there's no free press?
Mumo was also arrested in Tanzania in 2018. According to the rights groups, the government has also banned the gatherings of opposition politicians and prosecuted some politicians on fabricated charges. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Oriam Nyeko calls on the Tanzanian government to open up the political space so that the country can conduct upcoming elections.
The findings that we have, that media and civil society are effectively silenced, does not create a good environment for free and fair elections. So we are encouraging and urging the government to ease these restrictions on civil society and the media, to amend the restrictive laws.
VOA contacted a Tanzanian government spokesman for comment on this story, but calls went unanswered. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Success on the international trade front is a top issue for U.S. farmers. As VOA's Ken Farabaugh reports, this segment of the American landscape, which largely voted for President Donald Trump in 2016, faces difficult economic conditions ahead of next year's presidential contest because of higher costs to operate farms, falling profits, and an uncertain trade environment.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP, the United States signed with 11 other countries in 2016, would have given U.S. farmers more places to market their crops. Despite then-candidate Donald Trump's promise to withdraw from the TPP, largely on concerns over the impact to U.S. manufacturing jobs, Illinois farmer Wendell Schauman supported him, despite wanting the TPP agreement.
You're a farmer, you have a PhD, you're well-traveled, you understand how trade agreements and international trade works, and you voted for Trump.
Yes.
Since 2016, not only did the U.S. withdraw from the TPP, it dismantled the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. A replacement, the United States-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, or USMCA, is under review in the U.S. Congress. Meanwhile, the Trump administration simultaneously is waging a trade war with one of its biggest crop buyers, China, which imposed tariffs on U.S. corn and soybeans in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. This has affected profits for Schauman, but not his support for Trump's re-election.
What I hear on the other side, I'll happen to support what he's doing versus what they're proposing.
Schauman, who worries a Democratic president may impose environmental regulations affecting his farm operations, is not alone.
I was excited to see a Republican take back the White House, but I love the stance that we're taking.
I think he's doing what is right.
I think the majority of our people by far are still supportive of the president.
Illinois Farm Bureau's Mark Gebhardt says Trump has been able to blunt the impact of tariffs through payments to farmers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Market Facilitation Program. This year it cost taxpayers about $16 billion, on top of roughly $15 billion in 2018.
We want trade, not aid. We don't want to have to live hoping that we get another round of market facilitation payments. We really need, again, to find just a final way forward on not only the tariffs with China, but USMCA, Japan, EU, all these other issues that are out there.
Yet the lack of substantial trade progress during his first term causes concern among some Trump voters.
I really feel like he doesn't understand what happens out here in these flyover states. He's walking a very thin line with what's been happening in the ag sector.
Megan Dwyer says the Trump administration's waivers for oil refineries to use corn-based ethanol, the president's tweeting, and his mixed results on trade could affect her vote.
Some of his comments recently around ag are frustrating to me.
Amid an ongoing impeachment inquiry in the U.S. Congress, a straw poll conducted by Farm Journal Pulse in September showed 76% of 1,138 farmers polled support Trump in 2020, down from 79% in July.
I think there's a lot of people that are disappointed, but it's going to come down to the choice they give us. And right now, for most farmers, I don't think he's going to lose many.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Kirkwood, Illinois.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Nick Ivanov. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. Enjoy the day, everyone.
This is VOA News.